elevate.
Okay, so episode 15, and today we have a guest on, and it's Gary Rutherford from ARC, which is Addiction Recovery and Coaching. And Gary's going to share his journey on his own journey from addiction to coaching, basically, and what he's done to change his own life around to help others now who are on the same path that he was on before he started to change his own life around. So welcome to the podcast, Gary.
Guys, thanks.
Welcome, buddy.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. I'm very starstruck. It's great. So look, I've had the pleasure. You've asked me to come in to speak about my own kind of my own journey through things. So who am I, first of all? I'm a registered mental health nurse, and I'm currently working as an addiction nurse therapist, which is interesting because I spent about 15 years of my life practicing that. I did. I'm currently in long-term recovery from drug and alcohol addiction, 8 years now in August.
Brilliant.
So I've had my fair share of struggles throughout the way. I've had my ups, I've had my downs, but you know what? At the minute, I'm in a position where I'm able to give a bit back.
Yeah.
I first kind of went into treatment for drug and alcohol addiction back in 2009. I'd been away for a long time. I'd gone to university in Scotland, I'd come back, got heavily involved in drugs and alcohol, was very functional for quite some time, and then everything fell apart. Came back home, first stint in rehab, 4 weeks residential, came out, went a bit mad because first time I was clean and sober in a long time.
Yeah, when you say a bit mad, like...
As in, like, I had to deal with these emotions and I had to deal with these feelings that I had been suppressing for years with drugs and alcohol.
So that brought it out of you, kind of, in a way, or it made you ask questions?
Maybe, do you know what, it was the first time I was sober, and I think sober is very different to being in recovery sober. Like, I think if you can lock someone away and take away the access, then you can get sober.
Yeah.
But the process of healing and stuff then is quite a different thing, you know, and if you don't have those kind of emotional abilities to deal with all that stuff, then you're in difficulty, you know. So I came out of rehab, things went a bit crazy for a while, and then I went into my second rehab by choice this time, which was a massive thing, and we can talk about that later on too. And I stayed there for 3 months, and that was the beginning and the end of the journey.
Yeah.
Cool.
So there was 2 years of relapse. So there was getting sober and relapsing and getting sober, and that's part of the journey. And then 8 years consistent now in August. So
brilliant, man. Brilliant.
Things have been good.
Fantastic.
So this is obviously what's prompted you to start ARC. Which... You want to explain a wee bit about so people understand?
So ARC has been, it's been a bit of a dream for myself for the last maybe 4 years. So a massive part of my recovery was exercise. So I got sober and joined the running club and I hated it. And it was cold and it was in October and it was sweaty and I vomited after my first one. And do you know what, I thought I'm never going back. And I had a good friend at the time, and he kept bringing me there, and he kept saying, come on, you know, it'll get easier and it'll get better. And it did. So I started running, and then I started running every day, and then I started running sometimes twice a day. And then I thought, since I'm running, I might as well do a marathon. And then because of my, I suppose, my own nature, I thought, sure, I'll run all the marathons. And I did 5 in 18 months.
Right, as you do. Like,
I never ran again.
No.
But exercise was a massive part of my recovery. So the thing with ARC Fitness was I needed a way, and I felt that I wanted a way to share both the professional experience, my personal experience, and just my love for fitness and all things like physical activity, and not just a specific sport or something, but to enable people to get access to that, to enable them to reach long-term recovery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I never sell it as being the only thing that's going to get you clean and sober and recover, but it's a massive part of the jigsaw.
It's complementary to it, isn't it?
Massive.
It can probably speed the process along, make it a bit smoother. And
But at the end of the day, it's if you can replace something with something, something more productive, then of course it's going to help your recovery.
It's the habit thing, isn't
even
it?
Even to take it right back, Gary, like, you mentioned that you were obviously addicted to drugs and alcohol, so... A lot of people start out socialising with drugs, and it's a social thing, and they go to parties and they have weekends here. Did you feel that at any time or even notice that you were starting to lose control over that?
From a young age, I think, even from whenever I first started, so obviously it would have been weekend drinking and drug use, I just had that appetite that couldn't be, you know, you just couldn't get enough, and I was always a guy that had too much. And that's kind of how it went for a long time. Then I went to university, and, you know, you've got a bit of freedom, and, you know what, and access, things are there, and it just got worse and worse, you know. And it helped me manage. I would be quite socially anxious as a person, so it enabled me to be perceived as more confident. In social situations, the confidence. Like, I got a job as a doorman, and, like, you know, I'm not really... And by nature, that type, you know. But, like, I was consuming enough drugs at the time, you know, that gave me the confidence to feel that I could.
Invincible.
You know, and it just, it spiraled. And I was able to remain functional. So I went to university and I managed to get my business degree and a master's in human resource management, all whilst abusing drugs and alcohol.
It's actually impressive.
But functionality stops at a point.
It does, of course.
You know, so it did. And then...
So it went from kind of weekend use to daily use then, was it?
Daily drinking. So it would have been daily cannabis use at university, cocaine, and then alcohol was always prevalent. I mean, it's the most accessible. And that's the problem.
Most acceptable too.
And because it's acceptable and accessible, it's the hardest one to break, you know, because of the social norms, and there's loads of stuff around it. So then I was driving to work one morning and I crashed the car, broke my back, and that was my first introduction into prescription medication. So the doctor prescribed me Tramadol. So I was on a hyperextension brace on because I broke my L5, and I was on like a flat bed in the living room, and I was on Tramadol during the day, and I was hobbling to the shop to buy wine on my one crutch. And that started the problem then. And then there was daytime drinking, morning drinking, and I couldn't break it. And that continued on then for a few years. And then again, another accident. Lost my finger and my thumb. Broke a few ribs, dislocated shoulder. And just I continued to go.
Spiraled. You know, I've heard a few people that seems to be a pattern when they hit like some sort of bad injury. And their life just goes completely out of routine. A bad injury or something massive happens in their life. And just someone that wouldn't maybe have had tendencies towards that just completely goes off the rails, which is and frightening because it could happen to anyone. And that's why I'm saying this. Like, you know, we're sitting here, like, I'm empathizing with where you're at because I'm picturing you in the brace and I'm picturing you going to the Weimar and I can see myself
doing it
in that position. Like, you know what I mean?
We're creatures of habit.
Of course we are, man.
And we get in our habits and, you know, I know myself. Like, I am an extremely disciplined and routine's extremely important for me.
Of course.
And the second, like, change comes and I feel myself, like, I'm like, oh, it gets difficult.
Of course.
But through self-awareness, it's easier to manage. You know, so if you're going through life and something happens and you don't have the emotional strength to cope with it, then, you know, the tendency then to rely on those other crutches.
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, that's when that...
And how long did that continue for then, Gary?
You
were kind of like that. We were using a lot of prescription drugs and other drugs.
That went on for a solid 2 years. And that went from, you know, I would have been using... So the Tramadol was the first thing. And then I would have been using diazepam and then drinking as well. And then it literally stopped. So I literally came from where I was and I came back home. And that's when the challenge started then. You know, again, went into my first stint in rehab. No intention of going for myself. Like, this was everybody else's answer to fix my problem.
Of course. Yeah.
And you were supposed to have detox before you went in, and I didn't. And it was an awful experience.
How long was that, Gary?
Four weeks.
4 weeks.
It was
in
a 4 week residential. So it was and done and gone.
I don't know. Do we know the stats on, like, actual going into rehab and coming out clean?
Well,
staying clean.
The problem is staying. And as I alluded to that earlier on, so getting someone sober is easy if you remove the means.
Right.
Which is what residential treatment centres can do.
Yeah.
That's the easy part. The hard part is what happens next. You've all these maladjusted coping mechanisms.
Aye.
The brain gets damaged. The thinking processes get damaged. They talk about brain elasticity and all this sort of stuff happens. You know. So, but even like the Northern Irish statistics, because of how they're formed, you can only kind of get them 2017s. You can't get 2018s just yet. But there was 4,300 people were referred to the addiction services, and that's just here in the north. So yeah. It is.
4,300.
4,300. And out of those 4,300, 1 in 10 are using heroin. So 1 in 10 are using injectable heroin.
Okay.
You know, which is, if you were to think of one of your classes, you had 20 people in your class, there's two people that are, you know, injecting heroin.
Aye.
You know, and when we grew up, that wasn't a thing.
Aye.
We knew it happened and we watched the movies.
Yeah.
But this is happening in our society.
It's more prevalent now.
And it's becoming rampant.
Is that 1 in 10 people in this country is using heroin?
That's 1 in 10 out of those 4,300 people that went.
So people that signed into rehab, 4,300, 1 in 10 of them was actually addicted or using heroin.
And then in relation to prescription drugs, so in the last 10 years, the amount of people that have died by prescription drugs has increased by 10%.
Right.
So what is happening is you're seeing a shift in the drug culture.
Mm. Yeah.
So when we grew up, some of us, depend on your age, it would have been things like cannabis, resin, ecstasy, speed.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's prescription medication that's what's doing the damage, and it's prescription medication that are killing people.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's more people that on their death certificate is diazepam, and prescription drugs is caused as relatable to their death. Yeah. As heroin or opiates.
Even in the States too. Like the stats in the States for people that die with prescription drugs is massive. Huge. Compared to anything else. Compared to recreational. Compared to anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like prescription drugs is one of the highest killers in the States.
You know.
It's like a new form. This is like, what is
because
it?
Because it's so easily accessible. Right. Because you can go on the net and buy it and get it delivered to your house. Yeah. Or there's a guy down the street. And like all types of drugs, there's a guy down the street. But... Yeah. Maybe back in the early 90s or like 60s, 70s, coming through those eras, it was more recreational. It was party drugs and things like that. And it wasn't like you're saying where people are daily.
So no one's going to a party and taking diazepam, I'm assuming. No one's going to lie around at a party.
And this what's happened is, and that shift, and some of that, look, I suppose we can boil down to our own culture and the social nature that we have. Like the Troubles was a big thing. People were prescribed medication for that. But we've also, I think that we feel that we're owed. We go to the doctor, and that's what you're going to get because that's going to sort you.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to, do you know what? Anxiety and depression. Have you ever thought about doing some kind of CBT or a talking therapy or something like that? We just want to fix them.
You treat the symptom.
Yes.
Not the cause.
And that's it. You know, and that's just your benzos. Like, I mean, that's just your diazepams. At the minute, we're dealing with drugs like neuroleptic pain relief. We're dealing with Lyrica and Pregabalin, and like they're killing people. You know, people are just eating these things. You know, but opiates are a very dangerous thing and a very easy road to slip into.
Yeah.
You know, for example, I was just reading there, Addiction NI is a great organization, but, you know, they would say we had a guy that hurt his back and he was prescribed cocodamol. That's the start of his journey.
Yeah.
End of his journey, he's using morphine patches and smoking heroin.
Yeah.
You know, the guy didn't set out for that.
No, he didn't set out for that, no.
But the reality of the opiate use, you know, there's a progression there.
I get what you're saying here. Like, this isn't born out of recreation use. This isn't born at a party. Someone isn't going, here, would you like to try a morphine patch? You know what I mean? Or smoke heroin?
I know guys that went down that road then. Sadly lost their lives as well, too, because of that. Like, they were kind of party goers.
Mm-hmm. And,
then got under that as well, too. Like,
you know, and you have a culture of people going out. Xanax bars came in. People were out and they were buying Xanax bars. They were going into central nervous system depression. You know, they stopped breathing. Their heart stopped working. So there has been more deaths recently from the use of Xanax bars than anything. So, so we could turn around and say, like, addiction is getting out of control. It's taken over the youth that's doing all these things. However, we have to look. It's very polarised.
Yeah.
For example, and this is it's quite interesting because the British Medical Council, they produced a report on public health, and their findings were that today's 16 to 24-year-olds are the most sober to date. So we're having conversations thinking that, you know, there's this massive problem, which there is.
Well, yeah.
However, on the back of that problem, we are seeing more and more young people coming through that are choosing sobriety, that are choosing to not think that the binge drinking at the weekend is an acceptable norm. And maybe things like training. People are taking, you know, more responsible for their health.
Yeah.
People are more educated about their health. You know, maybe that's starting to have a shift.
Aye.
You know, from what that was. So it's nice to kind of see that, although we're talking about something that's really detrimental.
Aye, it's, as you say, it is kind of polarized, though, those results, but I would like to see what they deemed as sobriety or what that test study was, just to see what it was. But in saying that, I can see that. I can see people, young people, like that are more health conscious or more aware of what's going on, and then the complete opposite. Like,
definitely, because even when you take it back to like when we were 16 and that age, like there wasn't the massive influx of like especially facilities to go and train in. There was no gyms running around. There was very little. I don't think there even was a personal trainer when I was growing up.
Like, no.
At that age, I never heard of one.
No.
So that's massive compared to like when we were 16 or 17 or around that age group. So obviously people are becoming a lot more health conscious and a lot more conscious of what they can do instead of slipping under those.
And with that too comes the you look at mental health, you look at, you know,
you've seen obviously from, you've seen it from a, like a standpoint, your occupation is dealing with mental health issues. So you've seen the changes in the 10 years or whatever.
So the last 3.5 years I've worked, you know, I worked on a crisis service, you know, so we're at the front end of that. So like we saw the difficulties, we saw the top end, you know, we saw a broad spectrum of people. And the reality is a lot of people that were coming with mental health problems had, you know, it's like dual diagnosis. They were coming also with an addiction because, you know, they were trying to manage things.
Right, okay. So that was their trigger, basically, you was know. The mental health thing.
So, but people were becoming, in terms of mental health, the stigma was becoming less.
Yeah.
You know, and I think as the stigma with mental health reduced, then we're a bit freer to talk about things. Addiction
totally
was always that family thing that was brushed under the carpet.
Of course,
everybody knew somebody that drank too much or in their family, and they were, you know, it was like, Uncle Johnny, he drinks too much. We'll just, you know.
Yeah.
But the reality is, you know, it was a massive problem then. But now we're just maybe a bit, my goal is to make it a bit easier to talk about it.
Aye.
Yeah.
You know, because I believe nobody wakes up in the morning thinking, do you know what would be a fantastic idea if I have to drink every single morning just to function? You know, and we're quite hard in terms of our perception because I think people tend to see people with substance misuse problems as choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did that to themselves. They took that. But the reality is, they found a way to cope with something that they couldn't.
Mm. Yep.
And this is what it looks like now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's problematic.
That's 100%. And it's a good explanation, actually.
Detrimental to themselves. It's detrimental to the people around them. What can we do about it? And what can we offer?
So see, when you come out of rehab for the first time, many times you're in rehab, Gary?
Twice. Residential. Uh-huh.
For you, what was the difference the second time? When you came out second time, it was, right, this is it.
When I came out the second time,
was it your own?
The decision to go was my own.
Aye.
The decision to go was my own. I had realised that, you know what, life, and they talk, was your life unmanageable? All the, you know, whenever you actually have a second, they self-reflect and think, do you know what, maybe everybody else is right and I'm wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and I think once that penny, you know, drops, then you're open to change.
Yeah.
And once you're open to change and you're teachable, then that's the start.
A lot of people with addictions, I think they rationalize things themselves and they blame everybody else, and they're the victim a lot of times. And no, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that they aren't.
Yeah,
but I mean, it's always kind of like you say, the penny dropped for you. It was like, right,
it's the reason
you need to change things.
It's the reason not to change, isn't it? Because why would I change? Everyone else needs to change. Like I'm doing fine here. I'm coping and the triggers that's what I was going to just ask you, like, in terms for you, you said it was like a confidence, it was dealing with social anxiety, and that was kind of your trigger, and this was your cure.
And that's how it started off. And it started off, so it started off using to, you know, they manage anxiety or they manage any of the feelings. Like, I would have issues at school, and I was, you know, I used to be small and quite heavy, you know, and all that sort of you carry through the rest of your life, that insecurities, you know, and it kind of made me feel a bit more, you know, that confidence. But then it just became a way of managing life.
Yeah.
Like, my triggers were everything. Like, my triggers were hoovering the house, washing the car, because the nature of my using at the time was consistently on a daily basis, you know, sustained throughout the day. Yeah. Everything was associated. So, like, I wasn't a drinker. I didn't go to I went out, don't get me wrong, but I wasn't a drinker who went to the pub all day and did that. You know, everything was at home and everything was hidden. And it was just really difficult to break it.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, it was life.
Yeah.
So my entire life needed to change. Mm. Everything about it, from morning routines to night routines to how I walked down the street, the places that I went, everything had to change.
Mm.
It was tough.
I think because of the, our culture and the nature of society here, where a lot of that stuff is so just acceptable, especially alcohol, like, that's so acceptable and everybody just seems to do it, then it's just part of what people do is loving.
We're Irish.
I know, but that's there again, that's another it. Stigma. That no, that's a thing. What? An Irish man that doesn't drink?
What would you say to someone that maybe is in the position that you were in? What kind of advice would you give out? And I know it's not going to be a quick fix, but what kind of immediate... Is there services? I know ARC is going to be a service now coming, but what is there something, what is there available for people?
Do you know what happens? And so people find themselves in a situation and families panic and they don't know what to do and they don't know where to go. And the first thing will be, we need a detox centre in Derry and there's no services. Detox isn't the answer. Like, as I said, getting someone clean does not necessarily fix the actual problem.
Yeah.
That's where the work is. You know, but there's loads of services out there. People just, they're unaware.
Yeah.
And they're unaware of accessing the services. You know, especially families. Family supports, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Because there's support there for the people that are struggling, but there's not so much for the families who are actually quite core in it, because they're your support network. They're the people that have your back. They're the people that deal with all the crap. They're the people that pick you up, put you to bed. They're the ones that deal with that.
Yeah.
And they equally need support. Like, my advice to anybody at the minute that they're currently struggling, first point of call, GP. Go to your GP. You know what? People are afraid to go to their GP to talk about anything. You know, talk about their mental health, especially, you know, not being sexist. If you're a man or a guy, you know, you've got that kind of, not the bravado, but you've got your pride.
You're afraid to say something yet, for sure.
Go and do it. You know, chat, talk to your GP. And from that, you can decide. The first point is speaking about it. The first point is getting it out, because a lot of people with addictions try to self-manage. And if you try to self-manage for years and you haven't got anywhere, you're not really self-managing.
Yeah.
You know? So go to your GP. The GP can refer you on. And then there's loads of voluntary services. You know, you have Hurt. Things like Self-Harm comes in. You have Zest. You have Assert. There's Castle Street. You have Daisy. You have, you know, you have loads of services that are attached to that. There's Addiction NI. So there's actually a lot of things, but it's finding them.
Is there, like, I don't know, is there statistics on it? Like, in any other country where the percentages is really, really high of people that are suffering with addictions and things like that and go into rehab and come out and,
no, yeah. The thing,
things work instead of relapsing and falling back again? Well, is there anywhere else that seem to have got it working?
I'll say something properly, that is in James Clear's book, and I think I've said it before. There was a study done on Vietnam soldiers. Now, my stats might be out slightly here, but basically a lot of them got addicted to heroin when they were in Vietnam, serving in Vietnam. So I think the stats were like ridiculous, like 1 in 10 or 2 in 10 soldiers were addicted to heroin. And the actual recovery rate for heroin at the time when they came back to the US, so the US recovery rates was basically that 1 in 10 people that went into rehab came out and was clean and stayed clean.
Yeah.
What happened was, you're sitting with 2 in 10 soldiers going back to the States after the war was over, and back to the States, and only 1 in 10... Actually, 1 in 10 of the addicted people went back to using heroin, which is crazy. What happened and what they're attributing it to is taking them out of the environment and the triggers that were causing heroin. That heroin was easily accessible in Vietnam. Aye. Everyone was doing it.
Yeah.
They were stressed out to the max and they wanted to disappear from what they were doing. You know what I mean? In their minds.
Yeah.
And just their friends. Everyone, they were in an environment where people were taking heroin.
That's
but when they came back, it was gone.
It's that same
they couldn't cult. Access it. They didn't have the same triggers. They didn't have the people around them who were taking it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a massive fact. Now, heroin, as you know, is super addictive.
Yeah.
So for them to be able to come off it.
By just the change of environment.
Exactly.
Massive.
So you were mentioning about somewhere that did it right. So there's loads of things that you can look at. So there's two countries in particular. So Iceland, we'll look at Iceland first because it's the study that will be quoted most, you know. Iceland recognised that there was a serious problem with their teenagers in terms of substance misuse, drugs and alcohol, to the point where going to public places and public spaces was quite dangerous at the time. So they were like, something has to happen here. So they wanted to change the mindset, a social mindset. They wanted to see, these kids are looking to use to cope. So instead of letting them cope with drugs and alcohol, why don't we do something else that'll give them a natural high in their own brain chemistry? Let's provide things. So socially, they funded and they, you know, they provided access to sports facilities, and it's not just sports and physical, but like arts and crafts, and they started to give the young people purpose.
That's amazing.
There was green spaces, there was football fields, and the percentage rate phenomenally decreased. The children found, what they even did, and I think this is phenomenal, they give people in low incomes £250 per child per year.
Yeah.
Access to sports and arts facilities free for everybody in the household.
Right.
So they completely thought outside the box, because our government would just put up more advertisements saying drugs are bad, drugs will kill you, like get the youth off the street. And or they directed their attention to something else.
Going towards the focus, which is the solution instead of the problem. Being solution focused instead of problem focused. It's like we said before, that quote way. Mother Teresa, and they asked her, would she march against the war? And she says, no, but when there's a march for peace, I'll march for peace.
I'll march for peace.
So it's going towards
the
solution.
That's actually fucking, when I read that study, it was an article on the study, it wasn't a study, it was hair standing. I'm like, that is fucking genius. They were genius there when they done that.
That's like we spoke about before, and it's kind of the negative side of all of this. It's all negative, really, when you think about it, that side, but... And how much that when things do happen and things go wrong and you hear people like taking their own lives and stuff, and it's just saturated of that again, which again only raises more awareness of that negative side again. So how can we just flip back completely?
I'll actually bring that up now for you. So massively down point in your life. What have you seen as a positive? Like in terms of if this hadn't happened to you, where do you think you would be? And I'm not saying... But I'm trying to get people that are in that headspace that are maybe addicted and are thinking, my fucking life's going nowhere. You can probably look back in this and go, you know what? This has now created ARC. It's now got you probably the life that you have now with your wife. And you know.
So the down parts in all of this, and again, they be relatable. I mean, various suicide attempts. And I'll say that because the reality is it pulls you that far down. However, if I look at life now, like I wouldn't change my life for anything. The journey has been tough and the learning has been tough, but I get to share it now. And this is the thing, I think now, and this might be just me speaking, I do believe if you've gone through something that's been difficult and detrimental and life changing, I think if you don't use it and you don't share it, then it's quite a selfish act. Addiction in itself is selfish. Not sharing it is selfish. You need to get out there, because it's not a scientific approach to recovery. It's like, it's this practical. You just
it's
need
an emotional approach to recovery.
You need to take your life and you need to shake the crap out of it. And you need to like think, I need to change everything here. And that's a scary thought. It's a hard thought. It's an exciting thought. It's all the emotions, but it's a necessity. And you have to, you just have to let go and do it, you know. But you know, you need people, you need support, you need people around you, because no man's an island and you can't do it alone. But definitely, so the thing about ARC, so setting ARC was my way of being able to give back to people, my professional experience, my own lived experience, and again, the passion for physical activity. But the overarching thing about it was hope, because if, and I said this, I've spoke to people about this before, if you lose hope in recovery, then who are you to write off somebody else's, you know, journey? Who are you to say, no hope for your man there? You know, people said that to me and said that about me. My parents were told to throw me out. They didn't.
Yeah.
And like, if you lose hope, then it's gone. Like,
when you know somebody believes in you,
that's it.
It gives you that wee bit of extra belief in yourself. And it helps you kind of overcome those wee hurdles. Like.
So basically your advice to people that are around people that are suffering from addiction is, still have hope for them.
Have hope. You know, we have no right to write people off.
That's right.
You know, we don't. You know, we have tolerances and we have, you know, there's only so much we can take, and that's understandable. You know, and the reality for people with addictions is that the conclusion has to come from them.
Sometimes they have to get the rock bottom.
What was yours? Like, I was, this has been going around in my head. Like, what actually was the point where you went, you know what? Nah, that's it.
So, I've had a few, and this is what happens with people. They always think they've hit one until they hit the next one, and then they hit the next one. So, the broken back, the finger and the thumb. My first marriage dissipated, came back home, went into treatment. You know, the police pulled me off the bridge. They put me in the hospital. They put me in detox and in the hospital. And that still wasn't it. You know, and it wasn't. And even then, I had gone into rehab and got clean. The relapsing part was the hard part.
Mm.
Because I come out and people were like, look at him, you're doing great. And I was like, I'm doing great. Until it sneaked back in because the coping mechanisms weren't strong enough.
Mm.
And I went back in and I was convincing everybody that I was fine on a liter and a half of vodka. You know, you're not fine. And at some point it crashes. And the last time I drank, I was so sick. Physically and emotionally, and I detox myself without medication, which I'd never recommend to anybody. It's a very dangerous thing to do, and I'll never forget how that felt. And since then, I've never had a drink or drug. And
my fucking hairs are standing. Sir. That's unreal. Like,
and that's where I'm at. You know, but I mean, it's a journey, and relapse is a journey, and there's learning.
But you and yourself are like. Your whole journey and your whole story, and you wouldn't change it because, especially what you're trying to do now, because you can relate that to so many people.
Yeah.
And this is what makes you special and being able to help those people because you've been through it. You know exactly what they're feeling. You can resonate with them and you can understand. It's like trying to get somebody to compete in a show.
Aye.
You can understand when they're dieting.
Aye.
To obviously a complete extreme.
Aye.
But it's been able to relate that person because that they've been through exactly.
Massively. But yeah, and I'll say something else. The three of us are sitting here and we all know someone that maybe is struggling, or at some point in our life we've seen someone, or maybe we fucking struggled ourselves.
Yeah.
This isn't something that is foreign or alien to anyone that's listening to this podcast.
Not at all.
And I don't know if that is a bad thing, I guess, to say, but that's how much of an epidemic that this
society,
is.
It's society in general. Like, addiction has been worldwide for since human creation, basically. They've been addicted to some. It's been some type of substance. Like,
and it's about, and that's it. So you look at addiction, and I suppose my remit is substances because it's my background and it's what I know. But, like, it's no different for food, or it's no different for porn, or it's no different for social media or gaming. The reality is, that's what it looks like.
Yeah,
it's the behavior that's attached to it.
That's it,
and that's the thing. So you have to tackle the behavior. Unfortunately, mine's with substances, but it could just as easily maybe have been something else.
Yeah.
You know, and there was something I came across today, and it was. So we briefly talked about Iceland and what they were doing. Portugal in 2001 legalized, they decriminalized drugs.
Mm.
They had a massive opiate problem, massive heroin problem. They had a massive crime problem because of it.
Mm.
So they decriminalized it. And what they found was death from opiates reduced, heroin use reduced, crime reduced, people in jail reduced. But what they did, if people were caught with possession, then they sent them to a social worker or a GP and talked to them about addiction and talked to them about recovery.
Mm.
So they didn't put them, obviously, bigger amounts of traffic. That's a different thing. And they saw a massive drop in the usage. Now, they admit, it didn't take heroin home. It didn't take it away.
No.
However, it stopped all of the problems that were associated with.
Shit, I didn't know that. Never heard that.
Because it becomes more acceptable nearly for people. I suppose they become more open to it then as well, too.
Well, the fact that maybe they're sending someone instead of the jail, the social worker, first start, probably puts less strain on the economy because to keep someone in jail costs a lot of money. Sending the social worker is going to be...
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's about thinking outside the box. It's thinking about, right, we don't have to take you out and stick you away somewhere. That has its place. Of course it does. And people need that. Not everybody needs that.
No.
So it's countries that are, and governments and people that can think outside the box, and they set up these pillars. They have these three pillars, and it's just, and I was reading them today, and I was thinking, I really resonate to them all, and in terms of ARC and ARC going forward, it's something that I would really like to integrate just into it, because so their first pillar is there's no such thing as a hard drug or a soft drug, only healthy and unhealthy relationships with drugs.
Mm.
So it doesn't matter if you're using heroin and you're using cannabis, it doesn't make you better than that heroin user.
No.
You both have either a good or a poor relationship. And if you look at it as a relationship,
that's right, man.
It takes away the stigma and it takes away, that harshness from it. Again, the second one was an individual's unhealthy relationship with drugs often conceals frayed relationships with loved ones, with the world around them and with themselves. Why do people use?
Of course, man. 100%. That was 100%.
And the last one is, like, the eradication of all drugs is an impossible goal. And that's true.
Yeah.
We're never going to remove them.
No.
But we have to remove the want and the need and the desire for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
So that war against drugs is just absolute waste of time, waste of money.
If we remove that second one, the second pillar, like, the other two would kind of sort themselves out, because there wouldn't be an unhealthy relationship and there would be a lot less drugs. I'm not saying they're not going to be removed.
Well, I don't know how you could answer it, but if you had a magic wand and you had everything at your disposal in terms of being able to create the perfect thing for to deal with this, have you any idea how it would even look or what you would try and do differently?
It's my vision, and it's the vision for ARC, and I've had time to think about what this is going to look like. I would love to have a facility that people could come to and create a community, and I would be able to facilitate and provide physical activity. And people could come and I build a community of sober people in recovery, and they can help each other. However, I'm not saying it's quite controlled, but in a safe environment.
Yeah.
But I don't want to see people just clean and sober. I want to see people thrive. I want to see people, like, do you know what?
Change their life completely.
I want to be a nurse, so I'm going to go back and I'm going to do that because I can.
Yeah.
Because I'm not just an addict and I'm not just an alcoholic and I'm not a drug user. I'm actually somebody who's dealing with a problem.
Yeah.
Extremely successfully.
Yeah.
I want them to learn through sport. I want them to learn through exercise that they're confident and that they're capable, and they have their self-esteem is through the roof.
That works again is because when people have a real goal and a real purpose and a real direction, they focus their energy on it. And a lot of times when people don't have that goal, direction, purpose or focus and a bigger idea or bigger plan for what their life is, they fall into that trap then of confusion. They fall into that trap of going back down the road that they were on before, because they aren't kind of focused on the bigger aspect of where they can go with themselves.
I remember sitting on Altney Galvin, outside Altney Galvin, the bus stop is, with my girlfriend at the time, now wife, and like, I'm just going to be vulnerable in tears because I had no purpose. Like, I had, you know, I'd come out of rehab, nursing wasn't even on the radar then, and I just felt so, like, what's my purpose? Where do I go? Yeah. I felt I had purpose before. You know, I was managing things, and I had a job and homes, and then all of a sudden there was none, and, like, where do you go?
Yeah.
But when you get your purpose, and you get your passion, see when the two of them come together?
Yeah.
You know, so I went, and I applied, and I went back to the tick. And I flew through the tick, so I came out of the tick, and I'm not blowing me away, I came out with a distinction, went on the McGee, and flew through it because I loved what I did. I was like, I was doing everything. I was a student rep. I was like, dude, I would be doing everybody's coursework if I could, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they sent me to the Houses of Parliament. I was nominated for a student award, so I was over there. I was nominated for Student Nurse of the Year from the NMC, you know, and all because I was following my passion and my purpose.
Yeah. It's the same thing. I'm coaching a couple of guys online, and one of the ones that I went through with him was, I wanted him to go through his habits and identify his habits, and one of them, he says, was cannabis. Mm-hmm. If he could kick at, he'd be able to kind of get ahead in different things. And I was asking him what the trigger was, and he was saying boredom. And then I was thinking, right, well, trying to identify kind of what his goal was, and he didn't really have one. Like, and I was saying, can you see even how that is a trigger? Because sometimes when you're focused and when you're driven and when you have something to aim for, and as you say, when you have purpose, then sometimes you aren't triggered towards them other habits that are pulling you back. Like, so I think it's important for everybody, and everybody should understand what their purpose is and what goals they have and how they can achieve them.
And I tried, and I think the biggest thing that in recovery, try new things. Because you're not going to find out sitting in your house or in your sofa feeling sorry for yourself. So, you know, and like, if we're giving people advice and things to do in recovery, it's like, what can you do for your self-esteem? You can exercise, volunteer. Like, I volunteered with the local Down Syndrome Trust who did all the marathons for. And you know what? That was more for my self-esteem than helping the people. 100%. And I helped them and I loved it. Don't get me wrong, but it made me feel more human.
Yeah.
And from that, I experienced things. I experienced, like, skiing for the first time and tandem cycling and climbing and all of these things that I had never experienced before. And that all ties into where I am now, you know, the love for physical activity. And it's about having the courage to try something new and put yourself out there, you know.
See, with ARC, just back then, you talked about the physical activity side, the exercise and getting people on that, and obviously creating that safe environment. What about like reprogramming of any type? Would there be anything involving like some sort of therapy or...
So again, I would love, and we're talking about vision, I would love this to be this holistic approach to things. So I would love to facilitate the physical activity, but I would also like to look at, so CBT and talking therapies, motivational interviewing, things like that, they help people build up the resilience and the understanding of, you know, why am I doing this? What's the behaviour behind it? Help me understand. Self-awareness is key in recovery.
Aye.
You have to understand yourself.
Yeah.
And if you don't understand yourself, you know, you're going to come up with those challenges time and time and time again. I think everybody should do some kind of talking therapy or speak to somebody
100%.
That's not connected to them or have an emotional attachment.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I'm all for that, man.
Yeah. You know,
100%.
You don't have to have a suitcase full of problems, but like just come with yourself, talk to someone you don't know with no judgment and walk out the door and see how light you feel.
You know,
so to be able to offer that would be phenomenal,
you know,
and they have access to it, you know, so that's all part of the dream. At the minute, I recognize that I have this vision and I have been overwhelmed and I have been blown away by the people that have encouraged me and supported me. People that I have barely known messaging, contacting me, people trying to refer people to me, people sharing things, I'm speaking at conferences, I'm speaking in gyms. This wasn't here a month ago.
Yeah. No.
And it's so exciting, but I'm crap myself. And I think this could be such a wonderful thing.
Of course it is, man.
And I'm taking this approach at the moment. Like, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, I'm a signposting service. Come to me. I can give you help. I can give you resources. I can direct you. I can do that. But I would love to be able to bring people in and create. Yeah. I want to create an environment that's safe.
Yeah.
You know, and encouraging.
You will. Because as you say, look at the difference in a month.
Yeah.
Which, again, shows you the desire and the want for it. And 100%. The people need it.
That's what I was going to say. There's a massive need for this. This will roll out very quickly. And it'll grow very quickly because... like anything, like any business that's created and there's a massive need and a want, it'll boom. And I mean that in a sense of it's going to fucking help a lot of people.
100%.
You know.
And I'm making a point, you know, of doing this and doing it right. You know, anything that I'm putting out there, I can back it up. I can go in there, you know, there's a research base, there's an evidence base, because if I don't do that, it becomes my opinion.
Yeah.
And my opinion's just my opinion.
Don't get started.
Don't get me started on that.
I'm behind you on this one.
You know, it has to...
modules?
No, please don't get started on this.
For longevity, for this to last, from the outset, it has to be right.
Yeah.
And it has to be there. And I can't, it's not just me. This is ARC. This is for people.
Yeah.
I just happen to be the one that's driving it at the minute.
But you spoke to me about that before, and I said to you, but it will, and you will do it because you have that integrity and you know the journey.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not out there to try and fool anybody. It's not even for your own means or purpose.
This is coming from a different place.
This is from trust and integrity from yourself and who you are and what you're trying to do to help people. So
and that's
if it was if it wasn't in line with what you value, it just wouldn't work anyway.
See, if it's not perfect at the start, you know, don't worry about that, because it will be, because it's coming from a place of genuine intent.
100%.
And that's what I fucking love about this. This is why it has made my hair stand, because this is
even you saying like having it backed up with science and research, of course it's fantastic and it matters, but like as you said before, it's that emotional connection, and that's where people are going to resonate with. If you were talking to somebody, an addict, and you give them all these stats, they don't care about that. They care about your story and how you can help them. That's what is more important, really.
And add that too, like, I've learned by so many mistakes. I have listened to people that have given me advice and I have thought, well, that's great, but I know what I'm going to do. And I have made the mistakes. I have undertrained, I have overtrained, I have underate, I have overate.
Yeah.
I have burnt out. I have had to take time off. I have hurt myself. I've done all the things that people were warning me about. I've learned my lessons.
Mm. Hard way, sir.
And I think, and maybe, do you know what? Maybe I'm resigned to the fact that that's how I learn lessons. You know, I take that now as it comes. But coming in there, I have that. I know what it's like to, like, want to run three times a day, do the two bridges, there are three bridges they are now, like three times a day. I understand what it is to have the you know, the desire.
Mm.
And balance is key.
Yeah.
And it's something that I'm continually working on balance. I think we all do some level. You know, I have a very understanding wife who reminds me about balance quite often, which is good to hear. You know, so I have learned a lot of lessons in terms of sports and things. I set up ARC not to say, like, you must do strength and conditioning or you must run. You know, it's not about that. I just happened to start by running.
Yeah.
And I had it was a great friend, and he went on to be my best man. It's a guy called Tim Shields from the town. Now, Tim Shields is an 800 metre, you know, he represents Ireland in athletics. He's phenomenal. He's a phenomenal guy. He used to come to my flat at 5:30 in the morning to get me out of bed. They run out the Victoria Road where there was no lights and it was wet and there was puddles up to your ears. And he consistently took me, and he took me to Everton Square, and we did sprints and high knees and laps. And it was wet and cold, but he was consistent with me.
Yeah.
And that was my introduction to running. That could just as easily have been yourself, and it could have been strength and conditioning, but it was running. You know, CrossFit it's another passion that I have, and I talk about CrossFit because I think I learned a lot about personal resilience in CrossFit, because it's not easy. It's a very divided thing, I understand that, but going into something that is difficult, and you know that you're going to need it, and it's difficult to go into it anyway.
Yeah.
You learn a bit about yourself.
Yeah.
And in doing that, you know, you start to think, well, do you know what? I'll get through the day because I got through that.
Just got through Murph.
You know. And I was that guy that went on his day off, like, an open gym. I thought, I'll just do Murph on my own. You know, like, there's the wee thing that always needed to be fed. It kind of, like, whopping myself.
Yeah, but it's a healthier one this time.
100%.
Yeah, brilliant.
You know.
So, for people looking for help, Gary, where would their first protocol be? So if anybody wanted to kind of reach out, they can obviously find you on Facebook and stuff, but if people wanted to reach out for help kind of straight away, what would be the first protocol for them?
So I would recommend, obviously, the first point of call would be your GP. Your GP can refer you on to local services. There's other resources out there. There's community support that can direct you in the voluntary sector. You know, if you go on any, if you Google search addiction services in Foyle or in Derry, you know, a bucket load will come out. You know, there is a cert. You can self-refer to a cert. A cert can now work with families. You know, they do one-to-one therapies. HURT, another phenomenal organisation in town. You know, again, holistic therapies, talking therapies. You know, there's places out there. You have to take the step. You know, and if you can't take the step, if someone is there and someone's in your life and someone's seeing, you know, the despair, then they can as well. You know, and if they can be educated on how to support you, you know, all's good. But there's a lot of things out there. If it's a, you know, if you're struggling with your mental health and, you know, addiction's a mass part and your mood's low and you're feeling terrible, you know, attend your A&E or attend your others, you know, the services are there. And they're prepared to help. They're prepared to help.
Yeah.
Man, you know, I would say if anyone is listening to this that is dealing with this, is dealing with addiction, your story in itself and seeing you sit here now in front of us and listening to this has inspired me, like, literally is motivating me.
Thank you.
And you can take, like, I suppose, faith or whatever it is in this, that you can get out of this shit, that if you're in that hole, you can come out just like yourself, like, and it's amazing to see that, man. And I fucking really applaud you for even thinking about ARC, for getting off your ass and doing something, man. So amazing.
Thank you.
I know it will go from strength to strength. Like, this thing is, it isn't going away. It's going to just keep growing, man. And if we can help you in any way, we will.
Thanks. Yeah, definitely.
100%.
Excellent, Gary. Thanks very much for coming on.
We will find Gary on Facebook then. ARC.
So it's ARC Fitness, Addiction Recovery Coaching. And then on Instagram at ARC Fitness NI.
Cool.
Right. If anyone does, you can message the Facebook page if you do have any queries. You know, I'm always at the end.
You know,
even just to provide some advice or some direction. Yeah. Cool. I'm there.
Fantastic. Cheers, buddy.
Guys, thank you.
Coming on, man.
Bye. Elevate.